I am not saying today is the day. I'm not. But with the China news and the Apple news and the December jobs report coming out tomorrow, there is a chance we look back on today and say, huh, that's when it started. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday, the 3rd of January. Today, good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, a funny thing happened on the way to the next recession today, and it came from the chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. Kevin Hassett is his name. He was talking to CNN this morning from the White House driveway.
You know, and it's not going to be just Apple. I think that there are a heck of a lot of U.S. companies that have a lot of sales in China that are basically going to be watching their earnings be downgraded next year until, you know, we get a deal with China.
Without mixing my metaphors too much here, Hassett's point was that Apple might well be the canary in the economic coal mine, that the earnings warning the company came out with yesterday after the bell that we told you about, and which also helped torpedo stocks today, oh, by the way, that might just be a leading indicator of the problems a lot of companies are going to be having as the second biggest economy in the world slows down. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson, though, on our trade beat, was way ahead of Mr. Hassett.
Here's Ford CEO James Hackett on an earnings call in October.
Let me add that our performance in China clearly has been disappointing. I can assure you the leadership of the company.
Tiffany's CEO Alessandro Bogliolo in November.
What we have clearly seen in the quarter has been a shift in Chinese tourism and spending.
So and FedEx CEO Fred Smith in December.
China's economy has weakened due in part to trade disputes. As a result, we have lowered our fiscal.
So China's not just an Apple problem. But it also shouldn't be blown out of proportion, says Derek Scissors with the American Enterprise Institute.
Right. I would say you have Apple, you have the car companies, you have the chip companies, semiconductor companies. And after that, it's really scattered.
He says Apple's weak sales in China are due to weak consumer demand there. And most American firms just aren't that heavily reliant on Chinese consumers.
Wherever China can make something, they don't let foreign competition succeed that much.
Gil Loria, director of research at D.A. Davidson, adds another category that could be hit if Chinese consumers keep a tighter hold on their wallets.
Luxury brands tend to have a higher share of their sales in China because the Chinese consumer is a consumer that's often gotten wealthy recently and therefore is more attracted to aspirational brands.
Still, that Tiffany's clip I played, the CEO said Chinese tourists, an important segment for them, were spending less in the Americas and Hong Kong. But so far, spending in mainland China was holding up. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There is a corporate question to ask alongside Tracy's more macro piece about the Apple news, and it goes like this. What does a company do when its single most important product starts, and I stress here starts, to run out of steam? Apple's going to need to replace some of the iPhone revenue it told us yesterday it's losing. And increasingly, the answer for that replacement is services. The App Store, Apple Pay, Apple Care, all the rest of that stuff. Marketplace's Ben Bradford looked into how much Apple can squeeze from its services.
Michael Wade is part of Apple's problem. Wade's a professor at Swiss Business School IMD, but also a longtime iPhone user who no longer rushes to buy the newest model.
The days of the iPhone 3 and iPhone 4, I couldn't wait to get the new device, but that's just not the case anymore.
Apple cited the Chinese market for declining sales, but also blamed people like Wade, who are holding onto their phones longer. Wade says the company's solution is to squeeze more money from each user through services.
So I have an iPhone and I have an iPad. You know, a lot of my files are on Apple servers.
People like him, they buy music and apps and service contracts from Apple. The company is famous for pivoting from computers to music to smartphones. Analyst Timothy Arcuri at UBS says Apple is making another turn.
5 to 10 years down the road, services will be a much greater component of their revenue than it is today.
Right now, it's about 15% compared to 60% from iPhones. Arcuri says growth in services could come from new and current offerings.
Look at Apple Pay, for example. I mean, there's huge longer-term opportunities.
But this would be a big switch. Business professor Shoiket Chaudhry at Wharton is skeptical it'll be a smooth transition.
Apple has always been focused on product. That's been their strength. So it's not that easy to shift their focus on their business model.
Although he notes, Apple has reinvented itself with services before. It built the iPod, sure, but it was really selling the 99-cent song. I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
Despite all the media attention it gets, and yes, mea culpa on this one, Apple is not the only corporate story of this Thursday. Bristol Myers Squibb said today it's going to buy the drug maker Celgene for about $74 billion. The combined enterprise will have 9 products with sales of more than $1 billion a year. That includes some blockbuster cancer drugs as well. So Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains why Big Pharma is betting big on those cancer meds.
The price of new cancer drugs goes up 15 to 20% every year, and most of the time,
there are absolutely no restraints on the prices that can be charged for these drugs.
Rena Conti is a health economist at Boston University. She says there's no competition for most cancer drugs, no cheap generic version. Peter Pitts heads the Center for Medicine in the Public Interest. He says you can't blame the drug companies for going where the money is.
A large public company does not make investments unless they feel that they can have a return.
And Pitts says cancer drugs cost a lot because they're very expensive to develop. Cancer patients with good insurance may not feel the sting of these high drug prices. That's the case for David Mitchell. He has blood cancer and is now being kept alive with expensive infusion drugs.
My drugs cost about $300,000 a year.
Mitchell is 68, so Medicare picks up the tab. Mitchell also heads the nonprofit Patients for Affordable Drugs. He says cancer patients with high deductibles or copays can be on the hook for $15,000 to $18,000 a year, or even more if they're uninsured.
There are patients who are cutting pills in half, they're going without meals, they are going into debt.
Mitchell's blood cancer is incurable. He says patients like him need drug makers to invent new medicines to keep them alive. But he says there needs to be a balance between innovation and affordability. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There was no balance on Wall Street today. The aforementioned torpedoing of the markets, it was not just Apple, gang. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A guy by the name of Robert Kaplan said something interesting today. Mr. Kaplan is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, and he said on Bloomberg that, you know, maybe the central bank ought to hold off raising interest rates for a bit, and also that maybe the Fed ought to think about slowing down how quickly it's shrinking its balance sheet, which is it's a ledger, if you will, of its assets and its liabilities, a ledger that we ought to say, in the middle of the financial crisis, the Fed really expanded as it bought bonds and mortgage-backed securities to give the economy a boost. Because we usually talk about the Fed and interest rates, we figured it would be a good idea to look at this other tool the Fed has and how it uses it to control the economy. Victoria Guida covers the Fed for Politico. It's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
So what is it about what Robert Kaplan, the president of the Dallas Fed, said today that has people looking at it and going, hmm?
So the Fed has been shrinking its balance sheet. They call it kind of on autopilot. And what that means is, you know, up to $50 billion a month worth of bonds are rolling off the balance sheet, maturing without being replaced. And the Fed did that sort of deliberately because, you know, back in 2013, markets kind of freaked out the first time the Fed said that they were going to stop buying bonds. And right. So the Fed is very aware of the fact that markets are very sensitive to changes in the balance sheet. So as long as the Fed is sort of doing this on a steady schedule, they feel like markets know what's coming and that it's not going to be as scary. But that is affecting the whole system because it basically means that the Fed is no longer as big of a player in the markets, and it's making markets nervous.
Let me get you to explain the actual mechanics here. When the Fed goes out and buys bonds, it is putting liquidity into the market. That is, it's putting cash into the market, right? And what does that do?
It pays for that bond with cash.
Right.
And it pays for that bond with cash that wasn't already in the economy. So that's how the Fed
right.
adds cash into the economy.
And now when it says, as it has for the past 5 years, we're going to stop doing that. And in fact, we're going to let some of those bonds expire. That is doing what?
It's taking cash back out of the economy. And so, you know, that affects, you know, maybe how easy it is to get a loan. Because you think about it, if there's more cash out there in the economy, banks are more likely to lend it out. If there's less cash, they're less likely to do that, which is part of the point, right? The Fed's monetary policy is entirely based around, you know, loosening or tightening credit conditions depending right. on what's happening in the economy.
Right. Help me, last thing, and then I'll let you go. Help me understand the relationship between the Fed's balance sheet and what it's doing with that and the federal funds rate, which is the interest rate that the Fed controls directly and which gets so much attention every time Jay Powell stands up in front of a microphone after the Fed meetings.
Right. So that's actually a really interesting part of this is the Fed sets interest rates completely differently now than it did before the financial crisis. So basically, because the Fed bought trillions of dollars worth of bonds, there was way more cash in the system. And so, what the federal funds rate used to be is banks lending to each other. But because there's so much cash in the economy, banks don't really need to do that anymore because they all have enough of it. And so now the way that the Fed sets interest rates is by paying banks interest and raising the amount of interest that it pays those banks on cash deposits at the Fed. And so, you know, one of the main reasons why the Fed did that was to affect long-term interest rates.
Right.
And then the federal funds rate is sort of how it sets short-term interest rates. Basically, as the balance sheet shrinks, that affects interest rates over the long term, in addition to interest rates over the short term.
Victoria Guida, she does financial services at Politico. Victoria, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
Two words about professional sports right now. Word one is entertainment, which is what sports, for all the talk about the nobility of competition, that is what sports fundamentally is, entertainment. Word two is business, which at a professional level is most certainly what sports is. And one way to keep score on both those counts is literally the scoreboard. We are in the midst of a scoring boom in professional football and basketball. Some of that is just a natural evolution of those games. But part of it, though, is by design, because as Marketplace's Andy Euler explains, more points, more money.
The Monday before Thanksgiving, the Kansas City Chiefs and the Los Angeles Rams square off in the LA Coliseum. It's a scoring bonanza, back and forth the entire game.
Wow! The Chiefs take the lead! Can you believe this?
When time runs out and the scoring is all done, the Rams end up winning 54-51, the highest scoring Monday Night Football game ever. Third highest scoring game of all time. It's all any sports nerd could talk about the next day. Colin Cowherd on his Fox Sports TV show.
That was just fun. You had how many total yards? 14 combined touchdowns. I loved it.
The high scoring game shouldn't have surprised anyone. Through the first 12 weeks of the season, teams were averaging a full point more per game than at any time in league history. And this season only missed setting a record for combined points per game by a tenth of a point. Babe Laufenberg was a backup quarterback in the NFL for 8 years in the 1980s. He's now a Dallas Cowboys radio analyst. He says high scoring's
definitely the way the league is moving and the way the league wants to move.
Over the last few years, the league has adopted new rules to protect quarterbacks, and the league is changing the way referees enforce existing rules. Case in point, illegal contact. That's essentially when a defensive player hits a receiver to stop him from getting where he's trying to go. Illegal contact penalties in the NFL have tripled this season compared to last year. Another factor, players are getting more athletic all the time. Draft picks running the 40-yard dash in 4.4 seconds used to be remarkable and rare. Now it's routine. Combine better athletes with new rules to boost scoring, and Laufenberg says you get a show.
And these receivers are doing things that we've just never seen receivers do. How many one-handed catches have we seen in the NFL? If you went through the first 75 years of the NFL, my guess is you might be able to find five.
Here's another theory floating around about the points explosion. Today's athletes grew up on go-for-broke sports video games like Madden NFL, and they're taking that style of play to the field. Former University of Texas college football offensive lineman Michael Welsh is only a couple years out of school.
Video games were pretty rampant within the football program. People will literally be playing Madden and then going straight out to playing actual football, you know.
Whatever the reason for the offensive explosion, fans seem to dig it. I ran into John Weeks at a recent Dallas Cowboys game. For him, the more scoring, the better.
There's something you said about defense. Defense is beautiful. Defense is amazing. But offense sells tickets.
At the very least, offense attracts eyeballs. The NFL's ratings were up over last year, most weeks about 5 to 10%. It's not just the NFL where points are plentiful. Points per basketball game in the NBA are up almost 4% over last year, and so are TV ratings. NBA games are seeing their highest viewership in 4 years. Kevin Pelton writes about the NBA for ESPN. He says there's no doubt the game is changing.
The smart way to play now is to play fast, and you get criticized if your team doesn't play a fast-paced style. So at the team level, there's also been this trend towards playing a faster-paced, higher-scoring style.
He says nowadays, the run-and-gun style of the Golden State Warriors is the new norm. Case in point, in a recent NBA game, the Los Angeles Clippers set a record for percentage of three-point shots made. But you know what? They lost to the Warriors. Could be that the only thing that can counter all this dramatic scoring isn't tenacious defense, but more offense. Teams, leagues, fans, they're all fine with that. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, another story from Mr. Euler as it happens, sports and the money therein. Why do you suppose a league officially opposed to gambling, the National Football League in this instance, would make a partnership deal with a casino? Coming up.
I have stuff going on at work.
I know, me too. So how can I possibly put my phone down? First, though, let's do the numbers. You knew it was going to be the Wawa's, right? Dow Industrial's down 660 points today, 2.8%, 22,686. Not to be outdone, the NASDAQ down 202 points, that's 3%, 6463. The S&P 500 dropped 62 points, 2.4%, 24.47. We already talked about Apple a little bit. It sank nearly 10% today. Company that supply parts to Apple took a beating too. Skywork Solutions down 10.6%. Broadcom dropped 8.8%. Today, shares of Delta fell 8.9%. After the carrier warned fourth quarter revenue would be a little bit lower than it previously thought. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note, get this, 2.54%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The central coast of California is one of the state's key wine-growing regions. The climate, the soil, also because agriculture and all the ready access to water make the land and the grapes there key commodities, but also good investments in ways not always visible to those not in the know. Among those definitely in the know, though, are the people running Harvard University's endowment, which 5, maybe 6 years ago quietly started buying up vineyards up on the California Central Coast. Russell Gold had the story on the Harvard Endowment and its ag investments for the Wall Street Journal. Good to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me.
On the theory that the Harvard Endowment folks know what they're doing, why were they buying this land for above market prices all the way back in 2012?
Well, what they were doing is that they were grabbing land right in the middle of the drought in California when agricultural land that had good access to water was starting to develop a premium and basically made a premium on agricultural land that had water and started to discount land that didn't.
So, look, the catch is that to make wine, you need grapes. To make grapes, you need water. And that's what's going on here.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the weight of your average wine grape is about 75% water. Without water, you do not have grapes. You don't have wine. So in order to make a go of this agricultural investment, they needed to make sure they had good water. And that's really what they did. If you look at where they purchased their land, they made sure that they were where the water was still good.
just to get to the water-wine comparison, leaving the biblical story out of it, there's a great phrase in this piece, the math proxy for the investment in water turning into money with wine. Run me through that.
So remember the investor Michael Burry, who very famously made a big bet against the housing market running up to 2008. Right at the end of the book and the movie The Big Short, there's a little tagline in the movie that says, well, you know, Michael Burry is now investing in water.
Yeah.
And the way he's investing in water is, if you dig into it as we did, is that he's making purchases of agriculture. You know, you can't take a large shipment of water from California and take it somewhere else like you can with oil. So if you can't move water, what you can do is use the water where it is to grow crops and then move those crops. Yeah. California wine is a globally sought-after product. And so essentially what Harvard's doing is that they were growing grapes and developing wine in a place which still had good water and then selling that wine. But essentially what it comes down to is you can't do that without water.
So let's actually look farther down the road then, though. With a warming climate and water becoming the scarce commodity, Harvard's kind of sitting pretty.
They're going to be sitting on top of one of the largest groundwater basins west of the Mississippi. I mean, that in and of itself becomes an asset. And you know, you make a good point. The climate is changing. Water is going to become more abundant in places and more scarce in places. And if you're sitting on top of agricultural land where it's becoming increasingly difficult to grow crops, but you've got one of the last few good valleys which has water, that's going to be a good investment.
A word here for the surrounding grape growers and farmers up near this Harvard investment. One wonders what they're thinking about all this.
Well, there's some nervousness going on, especially among some of the local residents. You have a lot of rural residents out there, people who've moved out from the cities to less expensive land, and they're on well water. And all of a sudden, their wells are not deep enough. They've got to be paying tens of thousands of dollars to deepen their wells. And so they're getting upset. They're getting upset at some of these larger industrial type agricultural operations moving in that are able to drill wells 1,000 feet deep. And there's been some showdowns. There were showdowns in front of the County Board of Supervisors. There was some yelling and finger pointing. And I suspect that's just a little glimpse of what we're going to see more of in the future.
Russell Gold writes on energy, also water, most recently for the Wall Street Journal. Russell, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Here with the conundrum of this digital age, how to reconcile the useful and necessary capabilities that smartphones bring with the, well, with the distractions that they bring as well, right? Because business case in point, the travel industry. You know the drill, right? In any crowd of tourists, you will find lots of phones in people's hands, and they can be pretty useful for finding your way around the streets of Paris or showing friends and family what a great time you're having wherever you are, or, we should be fair, staying in touch with the office if you absolutely have to. But the thing is, there are large parts of the travel industry that would just as soon you put the thing away. Marketplace's Renata Sago has that one.
Some resorts are offering perks like free snorkeling tours to guests who manage to give up their devices for a few hours. A resort in Puerto Vallarta offers a detox concierge to replace phones with board games. Psychologist Art Markman at the University of Texas at Austin says cell phones are competition for an industry whose product is the here and now.
You're supposed to get away from everything. And the thing about your cell phone is it connects you back to all the things that you were doing before you were on vacation.
In a 2016 study, Markman found that people who use their phones for more than 2 hours each day during a vacation were more likely to have trouble remembering their trip. So it makes some sense for the travel industry to at least try to get people off devices, even if it means fewer Instagram posts featuring their businesses. It's lunch hour at the Wyndham Bonnet Creek Resort in Orlando. Waiters are shuttling menus, daiquiris, and mahi sandwiches to suntanned guests at the poolside restaurant. The area is surrounded by palm trees. There's even a lake nearby filled with koi fish. Harry Choman is not looking at any of this. The construction manager arrived from Buffalo, New York just a few hours ago with his wife and daughter for a weekend vacation. But he's scrolling through emails on his phone.
I have stuff going on at work.
His daughter, Carly, a 20-year-old college student majoring in communications, has her head down, too. She's Snapchatting to a sunshine-deprived audience back home.
It's snowing back home now, so I'm like rubbing in my friends' faces and I'm just laying by the pool.
What the Chomans also don't see across from their phones in between the salt shaker and the ketchup on their table is a sign that reads, phone-free zone. And here comes a resort staff member carrying a clipboard and some little gray pouches to explain.
Do you know much about it, or have you heard about it from anyone in the hotel?
Ted Zerfus, who runs food service at the resort, tells the Chomans he can put their phones in the pouches and lock them away. Among the enticements, a chance to win a five-night stay at the resort.
You want to lock them up for the lunch?
They say yes. Within seconds, they're eating and talking with each other. Wyndham Grand is thinking about rolling out optional phone-free zones in all its hotels this year. But asking vacationers to drop their phones doesn't always work out. Rusty Hartley launched his company, Off the Grid Tours, back in 2013. He tried to lead cell phone-free excursions to breweries in Canada and caves in New Zealand, but he found out quickly that people needed their phones for so many things.
Down to instructions, how to get somewhere, what time to be there.
So now he lets people use their phones on the tours. Yes, our phones are central to who we are, what we do, even on vacation. Like the Chomans, Sandy Higgins from Maryland is vacationing at the Wyndham Resort here in Orlando. But unlike them, she's not going to give up her phone. No way, no how.
I keep my phone with me for emergencies or if the kids have to contact us.
A recent study from Common Sense Media found 69% of parents and 78% of teens check their devices at least hourly. Divorcing ourselves from our phones on vacation? A bridge too far for many. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, we're going to make it a quickie because we're a bit tight on time. As you wait for your W-2 to show up so you can get started on your taxes, because I know you're thinking about that, right? This government shutdown note, the IRS, the Wall Street Journal reports, will still accept and process your tax returns while Congress and the president talk past each other. But the refunds that you're looking for, oh, they're going to have to wait. All right, that's all we got. Dow Industrials off 660 today, 2.8%. The NASDAQ down 202, 3%. S&P 500 dropped 62 points. That is 2.4%. Amir Bibawe, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Aaron Bekela, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.